love Jesus, they want to keep him on their side. But those of us who are Christians, I think, are concerned to know what stand he took with regard to such questions in his own day. Was he a radical, violent, revolutionary? Let me review for you briefly the argument which is used to indicate that he was. The author begins with that text, "I came not to bring peace but a sword." That there was the expectation that Jesus would restore the kingdom of David. The angel Gabriel in the Annunciation says, "And he shall sit upon the throne of his father David." Now we may say that in a spiritual sense, but it could be taken in a literal sense. The disciples walking with Jesus to Emmaus after the resurrection said, "We trusted that this was he who would restore the kingdom to Israel." And in the book of Acts, with the risen Christ, the disciples say, "Will you now restore the kingdom to Israel?" Now you might say that would be by calling on legions of angels, but it might also be by a military insurrection. The disciples, then, some of them at any rate, expected that he would be a king and that he would engage in a violent revolution. The next stress is placed upon a verse which in Luke, and it's only in Luke, is placed just before the disciples go to the Garden of Gethsemane, where Jesus says, "When you went on your former journey, you did not like anything, did you?" "No." "Well, now, if any has not a sword, let him sell his cloak and buy one." And they said, "Here are two swords." And he said, "It's enough." Well, enough for what? But the author thinks there are more than two swords. That as a matter of fact, the whole band went armed to the Garden of Gethsemane. Because when the authorities came to take Jesus in Luke's Gospel, one of them says to him, "Shall we smite with the sword?" Implying that they were all capable of doing it. All we know is that one had a sword, for he cut off the high priest's servant's ear. He's called Peter only in John's Gospel. In the others it says, "One of them that stood by." One of them in the enemy had a sword. But the author thinks that they all had swords. The rebuke of Jesus is differently given in the different Gospels and has different implications. In Matthew, "Put up your sword, for he that takes the sword shall perish with the sword." You shouldn't use it at all. In Luke's Gospel, "The time is not yet." That seems to be implied that it could have been used on some other occasion. In John's Gospel, it's Peter who is named as having done it, and Jesus says to him that he, Jesus, has come to save people by his death, and therefore his death ought not to be prevented. Well, that wouldn't interfere with a rebellion on some other occasion. So there are different reasons given for not using the sword at that time, but some of them leave open the possibility of using it at some other time. The author then moves from the garden to the trial. First comes the trial before the Jewish authorities. The Gospels indicate that they desired Jesus dead, but that the Jews were not able to put him to death without authority from the Romans. Therefore, he was accused before the Romans. The only charge which the Romans would consider was that of sedition, rebellion. Therefore, Jesus had to be accused of sedition and rebellion. But the Roman governor Pilate recognized that it was a false charge and tried to get Jesus off. He took advantage of a custom that once a year a prisoner should be released and gave the people a choice between Christ and Barabbas. And they shouted for the release of Barabbas, who was known to be an insurrectionary, and for the crucifixion of Jesus. This is the account given in the Gospels. The author says it doesn't ring true, that we have no knowledge outside of the Gospels of any custom of releasing a prisoner once a year. He discredits that story entirely. As far as Pilate is concerned, he says he can't imagine that a Roman governor would yield to the people in releasing one who was accused of insurrection. So he simply discards the whole story of Pilate's testimony to the innocence of Jesus and attempt to release him. And he claims that Pilate would never yield to a mob. Well, as a matter of fact, he did once. On an earlier occasion, Pilate sought to introduce into the temple of Jerusalem the standards of the deified emperor. And the leaders of the Jews went down to his capital at Caesarea Philippi, prostrated themselves and said, "Cut off our heads, we will not suffer it." And Pilate gave in. So this author is certainly not correct in his point that Pilate couldn't yield. And as for the point of Barabbas, I don't think we're to discard it simply because we don't know about it outside of the Gospels. We know so little about this period that often we have to take testimony from one source only, and frequently it is later confirmed by discovering something else. But he insists that Rome would have executed only an insurrectionary, and that therefore he must have been an insurrectionary. He also says that the Jews really didn't need to take the case to Rome. They couldn't crucify a man as an insurrectionary. Rome had to do that. But they could stone him as a blasphemer. And they did that with Stephen. And they didn't ask Rome for permission. So the fact that the case went to Rome at all must indicate that Rome took the initiative and that Rome was right. He was a rebel. And on his cross they put the words, "The King of the Jews." That was the accusation. And it was correct. He was trying to be the King of the Jews. Well, if that's so, says this author, what are we to make about all the passages in the Gospels which indicate that it's wrong, that this is not the correct picture, and portray for us a peaceful Christ? What shall we say to all that? He says that the early Christians suppressed this because they were being persecuted by the Roman government for their refusal to worship the emperor. And they wanted to prove that they were merely passive disobedience on the matter of emperor worship, but not insurrectionaries. And therefore they suppressed, as far as they could, the evidence that Jesus himself had been an insurrectionary. That the Gospel of Mark was written, this author assumes, in Rome, in the year 70 AD, the very year when Titus celebrated his victory over the rebellious Jews. And this was a time when the Christians were particularly eager to dissociate themselves from any Jewish rebellion. Well, what are we going to do with the Sermon on the Mount? How about all the passages on non-resistance, love for enemies, and so on? All that, he says, was written by Christians in Alexandria about 80 AD, because the Alexandrian Jews never were revolutionary. They were living down there in Egypt. They were getting along fairly well with their neighbors. They didn't approve of the rebellions in Israel. They were Egyptian Jews. Therefore, they concocted, shall we say, the picture of the Pacific Jews. Now that is the general argument of this book. I asked the New Testament specialist what he thought of it. He said, "I think it's the finest case, the most defensible case that can be made for an indefensible position." There are a good many weaknesses in it. I pointed out a few little details. This is not overlooking the fact that there are some difficulties in the accounts of the trials before the Jews and before Rome, and there are details that are difficult to reconcile. taking all that into account, the total picture this man gives brings one into some very severe difficulties. One is, if Jesus was an insurrectionary trying to throw out Rome and restore the kingdom of David, why did the Jews reject him? Why did they not treat him as a hero, like Judas Maccabeus of an earlier period, or Bar Kokhba of a later period? If he had been a zealot leader, he would hardly have been rejected by his own people. Another consideration is that this man leaves entirely out of account the writings of the Apostle Paul. Now, as a matter of fact, the letters of Paul are earlier in point of fact and date than are the Gospels. And there isn't a hint anywhere in Paul of this revolutionary activity or interest on the part of Jesus. Well, undoubtedly, he would reply that Paul was a missionary to the Gentiles, and he also wanted to tow it all down. Well, it's strange he wouldn't betray himself by letting out a hint somewhere. And there's no such indication anywhere. Besides, Paul was brought up in the school of Gamaliel, a Hebrew of the Hebrews, even if he was born in Tarsus. His silence is rather too much to overcome. And another point is that we have to assume such a conspiracy of silence and suppression as to make the authors of the Gospel guilty of deliberate deception. It's hard to think that people who were giving their lives for their faith would so distort the picture of their hearts and play down for the sake of their own safety what really lay in their tradition. These are difficulties that are a little too much to overcome. Now we might go into the question of what Jesus really did think about politics, about resistance, what the Apostle Paul felt about it, and that might well be the subject for a lecture of a lengthier character. Here, I would merely call attention to one point, and that is that as a matter of fact, the New Testament, the writings of Paul and the Gospels, introduce a completely new picture of the character of peace. With the Greeks and the Romans, peace is the absence of war. Our word peace, pax, comes from the word pactum, a pact, an agreement, a covenant not to fight. Pax is just agreeing not to fight. It is the absence of war. With the Hebrews, peace is conceived in material terms and is almost a synonym for prosperity and security. Peace be within thy walls, and prosperity within thy palaces. Peace is security to such a degree that the word peace can be applied to a military fortress, Jerusalem. Jerusalem has the word peace in it. Yom Shalom. Jerusalem, Yom Shalom. The peace of Yom. Peace of the great fortress. The military citadel, that is peace for the Jew. For the Christian, the opposite of peace is not war, but contention, spite, malice, slander, backbiting, contention. The companions of peace are joy and long-suffering, patience, compassion. We have all the wonderful past. passages, not only in the Gospels, about turning the other cheek and loving the enemy and praying for those who despitefully use you. We have all the passages in Paul, on finds them in the Corinthian correspondence, in Romans 12, in Galatians 5, Ephesians 4. They're almost everywhere. And the great hymn of love, where peace is not contentious, suffering long, is kind. We have the passages where Jesus rebukes the spirit of those who seek power and prestige. It is so among the Gentiles. It should not be so among you. He who is the greatest among you is he that serves. It is service, self-effacement, resignation, suffering, with joy in the service of the Lord. All of this is the meaning of peace.